Hi, everyone. Welcome to episode 8 of the Parent Teacher Podcast. This is Casey, your host. You can find more about me at my website, reorientedadvocacy.com. I am a former special ed teacher, a parent. I have ADHD. Just a lot of things have pushed me to want to reach out to both other parents and to teachers and give some information so that you can know which questions to ask and hopefully find resources you need as you're navigating the educational system. It is now August, which means we survived July. We have gotten through a good deal of the summer. And I had the privilege of sitting down in early July with Matt Cohen. So Matt is a special education attorney in downtown Chicago. I first heard his name when NPR was covering a story about an investigation into the special education practices at Chicago Public Schools. I contacted him because it was right when I was thinking I wanted to find out more about advocacy, and Matt introduced me to COPA, our professional organization. That's COPAA. I'll put that link in the show notes. Matt's also been involved with CHAD. I could tell you all the specifics, but I'll refer you to the bio page in the show notes. CHAD is the professional organization for ADHD. And Matt has a book. It's Special Education Advocacy. And it's a guide for parents and practitioners. I was looking for the actual tagline. The book isn't sitting behind me on my shelf because maybe I lent it to somebody. So you can also see the link to that in the notes. It's actually a really great resource, I think. Concise, covers a lot of information. And it has a lot of common sense built in, which is something I always really respect about getting Matt to weigh in on something. Always talks about the reality of what is best to do, not just the technicalities, and is very generous, again, in informing and just being helpful. So I contacted Matt and asked, could you talk a little bit about special ed law and maybe, you know, how parents can avoid ending up retaining an attorney? You know, what are some things to know? And he covers a lot of information. So I hope that you'll find this helpful. Again, I'll put all that contact information in the show notes. I started our conversation by asking Matt how he got interested in special education law.
The background is that I knew that I wanted to be a civil rights lawyer when I was a kid, and then narrowed that down to wanting to do school-related civil rights issues, in part because I went to Evanston High School, which is a large public high school in a community that's ostensibly integrated, and felt that there were many disparities in the way Black and white children were treated and large gaps in terms of access to the many great things that the school had available for the Black kids particularly, and a real struggle with how to make what was supposed to be an integrated space integrated in a meaningful way. So I went to law school thinking I was gonna do civil rights work around race discrimination. And just by happenstance, got a job after my first year of law school in the Chicago Legal Aid office that focused on disability rights issues. For people who haven't gone through law school, you take what job you can get that's as close as possible to your interest as you can find. That's not always a perfect fit. So that wasn't exactly the target that I had had in mind, but it allowed me to get into disability rights and civil rights through that. And the special ed law was just coming into force at that time. And so I began to do special ed cases while I was at Legal Aid as a law student, and then fell in love with that and realized that it had an element that involved mistreatment of minority kids. So there was an element of race discrimination within the special ed system. It also involved mental health law, which I had some interest in, and school reform. And it was a new area that most people weren't even familiar with. So I was able to kind of get up and involved up to my neck very quickly. So many people asked me, you must have gotten into this because you had a child with a disability, which is how many people get into it. And in fact, that's not what happened with me. I got into it before I even had kids. But it's worth saying that I did have kids, and after I was already a special ed lawyer, and once I had kids, within a couple of years, discovered that my older child had significant disabilities. And so it turned out to be a fortuitous choice for kind of personal reasons as well, because I was able to probably be a much more effective advocate for my child than a typical parent would be, because I had the benefit of all that advocacy experience already. And on the flip side, was able to learn an enormous amount as an advocate and lawyer that I wouldn't have learned without having had a child with a disability, that I think give me an ability to understand and share the perspective of many other families, that both allows me to empathize with what people are experiencing and to try to be helpful in a practical way, in a real world way, based on my own experience as a parent. And perhaps as an exclamation point to all of that, my son's now an adult, and so I continue to learn from him as I deal with the adult disability world. And now that's a part of my law practice too. And I continue to have the interaction of both the benefit of my experience and expertise for his sake, and learning from him for the benefit of my own development and the ability to help other clients.
Yeah, I share that experience too, I think, in that I was a special education teacher before I was a parent. Right. And I'm like the irony of all those years.
Sure.
Right. So I wanted to ask you, because in addition to working on policy, and really I think of it as things beyond the school level, at the state level, I'll probably link to some of what's recently gone on with ISBE and CPS and partnering with other organizations. You do a lot of work directly with families.
Right.
And at the school level, so dealing with individuals. And I think that I've heard you have pretty practical advice in the past about ways to resolve conflict, or just kind of not legal, but even practical approaches. And so what I wanted to ask about today is, what are some of the things people should really understand about partnering for schools, partnering with parents, or building trust with parents, for parents working well and effectively with schools, so that they, so they don't end up retaining you, mm-hmm. you know? What
sure.
are some of the good practices?
Well, rather than jumping right into kind of the weeds, I think I'd like to answer that by starting out at a broader level. And the broader comment would be that all of the things that parents have to deal with in relation to special ed are driven by the federal special education law, the IDEA. And that law, which was adopted in 1975, was in many ways at the time revolutionary and a great law. And at the same time, in many ways, has proven to be have many gaps and flaws and ambiguities, which make it subject to vastly different interpretation depending on your point of view. And I would go so far as to say, in many respects, was a setup for failure for both parents and educators, and then ultimately for kids, because it both creates high expectations and then fails to deliver in relation to the details. So the very first thing, and some of the comments I'm going to make about the law then translate to practical things that parents need to be aware of. So the very first thing that parents should be aware of is that the when the law was passed, the promise was that the federal government would provide 40% of the funding for special education. Since passage in 1975, the federal funding has never gotten beyond roughly 17%. And in percentage terms, that's a big number. In real dollar terms, that's representing billions of dollars of funding that had been, in effect, promised that wasn't delivered. And the reason that I bring that up is that one of the things that becomes a point of conflict right off the bat is that parents naturally want their children to get as much as possible from the schools. And I think educators in general have the same desire, but without enough money, they're put into the position of having to set boundaries that are based on resources rather than based on what's really necessary for the child. And so for parents, there's kind of a mixed message that I need to share, which is that you should always be trying to get everything that your child needs, but recognize that there are real financial constraints on the schools. And although those are not legally supposed to be an excuse for not doing what your child needs, it puts the educators in a bad position. And so I guess the point there would be not that it means you shouldn't ask for things your child needs, but at least you need to be conscious of the position that the educators are in and try to sort out when they're trying to do the right thing and are legitimately constrained so that that's not really their fault in a sense, versus when there really seem to be resources available and they're saying no for other reasons, or perhaps because they're just not sensitive to your child and what they individually need. So that's the first place. And I guess, so part of the theme of my thoughts about what can be done is that parents need to try to, at all times, be aware of what the factors are at play in how decisions are made, how they're viewed, how their children's needs are viewed, and to try to be, as much as they can, sympathetic to the educators, empathetic with the educators, and respectful of the educators, rather than assuming that the educators are always making choices that aren't what the parents want, kind of deliberately, rather than because that's what the system or the funding requires. So that's one example of the way that the laws are set up. A second way that the laws are set up, and it ties to the finances, is that the law gives parents a very high degree of involvement in the process that's dramatically different than it is for parents in regular education, including access to information, the right to regular reporting, the right to participate in meetings that have to be scheduled at times that are convenient for the parent, up to and including the right to seek legal recourse if there's a disagreement, and to have something called a mediation meeting or a due process hearing to work problems out outside of school, and with the due process hearing conducted by a hearing officer who has the legal authority to overrule the school. And there are lots of different rules that govern how the school is supposed to operate in special education. My experience is they're complicated. They require a lot of time. Many of them, maybe even most of them, have very good reasons behind them. But because the educators feel overwhelmed and are understaffed and under-resourced, a lot of those procedures end up feeling burdensome to the school staff, and sometimes they even become resentful of the obligation to follow some of the technical rules. And so then this leads to a different disconnect, which is that the perception that the parents have correctly is that the law gives them a lot of rights that are different than the rights that families have in regular education. And then when they seek to operate according to those rules and discover that the school staff are either not operating according to those rules or are resentful about having to operate according to those rules, that sets up a second flashpoint, because the parents are actually doing something that's absolutely their legal right, and the school should be paying attention to those rules. And at the same time, for the schools, the teachers are saying, we're doing our job, we're competent, and leave us alone and trust us. And even though they might have understandable emotional reasons or even ego reasons for feeling that, it doesn't alter that they have legal responsibility. And then on the flip side of that, sometimes the parents become preoccupied with some of the details of the rules, even when the school is doing a good job. And to some degree, the parents can sort of lose the forest through the trees, because they may be upset about the problems with procedure, and the school folks are saying, your kid's doing well, we're doing a good job, why are you giving us a hard time about the details? Which is great for them, understandable for them to feel that way. And yet, again, flipping backwards, then if the school turns out not to be right about the quality of the program or what they're doing for the kid, and they're not following those rules, then they're effectively depriving the parent of the ability to monitor and have good involvement to see what's going on and to express their dissent when they feel it's sufficiently important to do that. So again, and I don't mean to beat a dead horse, but the idea of kind of a setup for failure is that these rules are very important. They're not self-executing. It's not like they're the special ed rule police running around making sure these are done. And yet, sometimes they can be overly burdensome or even give the parents kind of a mistaken sense of form over substance. And on the other hand, they often provide important protection for parents, and the school blowing these rules off can really shut the parents down on things that they have a right to be involved in. So again, a big setup.
I think the key term that causes the conflict, I guess, would be a disagreement over that statement that the kid's doing well, right? Mm-hmm. When the parents aren't seeing the kid doing well, and the school is saying the kid is doing well, at least in my experience, because I work primarily with kids who are, you know, twice exceptional or maybe test well, or, you know, it's not very apparent. Mm-hmm. I think that that disagreement of how well is this kid doing?
Well, let me make one other point and then come back to that. Because okay. In terms of the setup for failure, there's just one other thing I want to throw into that, which is that some parents are aware, and even there are some training for parents that puts out the message that parents are supposed to be equal partners in the IEP process. And the procedures that I was just describing are intended to kind of create the vehicle for parents to be equal partners. But the law doesn't actually say they have to be equal partners. That was language that was in what's called the legislative history. So the legislators were talking about that the goal was for parents to be equal partners, but there's no legal definition of what that means. And in some ways, because the spirit of the law was intended to make people equal partners, the parents equal partners, but the reality of the law is that ultimately the school decides, and if the parent is unhappy, they have a right to a due process hearing. That's actually something very different than equal partnership. That's in fact a relationship that is in most ways, even with the right to a due process hearing, stacked against the parent. And then, again, in relation to just expectations and perceptions and emotions, if the parent comes into an IEP meeting thinking that they're an equal partner, and the school staff come into the same meeting thinking that the parent should be seen but not heard, you've got a bad situation from the get-go, because there are dramatically different understandings of what the law requires and what the parent's role is. So even many parents, even to this day, 40 years after the law was adopted, many parents say to me, I refuse to sign the IEP, so they have to do what I wanted, right? And that's a mistake. The school can implement an IEP even though the parent refuses to sign it. unless the parent requests a due process hearing and the hearing officer overrules them. So parents then oftentimes understandably get furious because they assumed that by not signing the IEP, they could prevent the school from doing whatever it was doing. Again, based on this idea of equal partnership, and equal partnership conveys the right to veto, and that's not how the law works. So then they get into trouble because they made an assumption based on the flowery language that wasn't actually what the words mean in day-to-day interpretation. So then, Casey, you asked made a really good point about the issue of how much progress is the child making or what do they need? And that's a source of huge dispute. And it has two components. One is, what is the nature of the child's disability and how serious is that disability? And the law provides all sorts of mechanisms for evaluating kids, reevaluating kids, and getting input from parents and their private evaluators about kids. But kids are complicated, and evaluations and test data and all of that can be complicated. And as everybody knows, statistics are always open to interpretation and can mean different things. It's the classic, is the glass half empty or half full? So everyone can even agree on what the data says and have different interpretations of whether that's good or bad. And even those different interpretations of good or bad can lead to disagreement as to whether the child even has a disability or not. Mm-hmm. So for example, the child might have a reading problem and the school uses a certain part of the child's performance data to say they're doing okay because they're getting passing grades and their scores are at least kind of okay. And the parents look at the scores that are only kind of okay and says, well, the grades, you're really just passing the kid through. The scores you've got are kind of okay, but then we have some other scores that show that in particular areas, actually the reading's really below. Mm-hmm. Or they might even have a problem, you've dealt with twice exceptional, of a very bright kid who is performing way below their potential, but still performing better than other kids who are not as bright. And so all of these things become the subject of dispute. And so one practical suggestion for parents would be never throw anything out. When I went in to clean out my parents' house when they moved out of their house in their 80s, my brothers and I found an entire storeroom that had every report card, every assignment, every class painting, and everything else that. They're four boys, so it was a lot. And they weren't saving them for purposes of legal documentation. They were saving them just because they were nostalgic. But in fact, when you have a child with a disability, you should never throw any of it away. So that's a really simple but very important point. And by the way, that goes speaks to email as well. Keep any email exchange that you have with school staff, and preferably download it onto a flash drive or print out a hard copy or whatever, so that whatever happens, you have copies of it. And even for many kids, there will be notebooks or logs that go back and forth between home and school. And it's always a good idea for parents periodically, maybe once a quarter, maybe once a semester, whatever it is, but to Xerox those so that you don't find yourself in a position where the end of the year comes along and the teacher is keeping it, or a conflict comes along and suddenly the stuff that was going back and forth disappears. You should even keep a log of phone conversations that you have with school staff so that it doesn't prove that you're necessarily right, but it at least gives you a record that increases your credibility if there's a dispute about things that have happened. And because there are so many disputes over how a child is doing and what the data means, oftentimes those things that the parent keeps can become very powerful in demonstrating the things that the parent is expressing concern about. So, for example, if the school says the kid is doing fine in language, arts, and writing, and the parent brings in five writing assignments that are filled with grammatical errors and spelling errors and very poor content, the general statement that the school made, or even the statement that the school made based on some testing, becomes hard to stick with in the face of real world actual work that was done on a day-to-day basis that shows a different picture. And incidentally, that can go in the other direction as well. Sometimes the parent needs to prove that the child can do better than the school says they can do. So it's not always to show that the child can't do something. Sometimes it's to show that the child has a skill that the school's ignoring. But in any event, documentation is important. Another thing that if parents, very simple thing, but if parents are hearing the school talk about testing and they don't understand what the tests are for or what the data represents or even what the acronyms are that are being used, they really need to have them explain that. And they have a right to have the school explain it. And if for whatever reason the school is not explaining it, they should search on the internet or find a private person who can, who's knowledgeable about those tests to understand it. It makes me very sad, though I have to say, in some ways it's also upsetting. The number of times families come to see me and they're basically accepting the generalities of the school without understanding what the tests were for, what the data actually represents. And oftentimes what the attorney or advocate can do is actually explain to the parent for the first time what the testing about their kid meant. And that shouldn't be something that the advocate or attorney should need to do, because that should have happened much earlier. But many parents have not really understood that. And so they're really trusting the school and relying on their conclusions without understanding what it's all about.
I'm thinking, like you said, in some cases, we see a different kid at home than mm-hmm. you do at school. And the other thing that's been a challenge is that grading has always been subjective. But I think even now, it's important that you're able to back up, like you said, with teacher comments. There's a good resource I've shared with people on the Raise Your Hand website about memorializing phone conversations. Mm-hmm. And I think that's good advice, not only for parents, but also for teachers.
Yeah, sure.
You know, let's keep a record on this. So that's one thing you've said is, I think just from a legal aspect and from a practical aspect, understanding, maybe feeling like you can go to someone to ask those questions is a challenge for mm-hmm. parents. I think of, especially at the high school level, something when parents contact me, one of the big questions is we don't have a go-to person. We don't, you know, mm-hmm. like the IEP meeting is sometimes the only time they feel they have a forum to yeah. ask those questions. And that's unfortunate because it's a very limited sure. amount of time.
So two things about that. You know, one is that there should always be a case manager, and that would be a logical person to go to. Then any clinician who's involved in the school team should be available, and the parents always have a right to go and ask questions. So even though I think you're correct that many parents feel that the IEP meeting is the only time they can discuss, that's certainly not legally correct. And in fact, best practice and good team involvement would give the parents the message they're part of the team on an ongoing basis and would have a right to call at any time. And the team and the parent would be communicating on a more regular basis and certainly in anticipation of any IEP meeting and to discuss any testing that's come up. So anytime the parents are unsure or confused, they should absolutely ask in advance. I want to say one other thing about the idea of progress and then talk about the idea of sharing information. One thing that I experienced with many families, and this is also as a parent particularly, I can relate to this, but when you talk about how do you measure progress, parents will say, my kid's not making enough progress. They may say, my kid isn't making a year's progress in a year's time. And then I say, well, what's their disability? And they answer. And then my question is, well, what impact does their disability have on their ability to make progress? Because for many parents, because they don't have a reference point and maybe even don't understand how the disability affects the functional performance of their child. They know their child has a disability, but they don't kind of understand the detail of it or internalize it. Then they get very frustrated by the lack of progress, and it may be that the child should be making more progress than they are, and the reason that they're not is because the school isn't providing enough services or isn't using the right methods or techniques. But it may also be the case that the reason that the child is not making the progress that the parent is hoping for is because the child has that disability, and the consequence of that disability is they are simply not going to be able to make as much progress as a typical child. And so that's a very important question, and one that actually, at best, there's only some combination of art and science in figuring it out, because no clinician or educator can predict with absolute certainty how much progress a given child will make, except perhaps make an informed guess on what they've experienced with that child to date or what they've experienced with children who are very similar. But no one can make a precise prediction. But you can try different variables, and if the child is not making progress, try different things to see if that improves the progress. But my point is that rather than just assuming that the lack of progress means the school isn't doing something properly, the parent needs to try to understand what is causing the lack of progress and whether that's predictable due to the disability or due to an inadequate level of service. So when we're talking about the issue of progress, parents need to be aware of what the school district's legal obligation is with respect to the extent of progress that the child is supposed to be provided, or the programming that will assure a certain level of progress. That question speaks to one of the biggest legal issues and points of confusion and conflict between parents and schools, which is, what is a free, appropriate public education, and how much service should a school have to provide in order to create the likelihood a child will make a certain amount of progress? So in addition to the point I was making earlier about it being important for the parent to sort out what is reasonable for the child given their disability, that's the starting place. Then the next question is, what should the school have to provide and what should the goal be? And of course, all of us as parents, and I would say probably most educators, and certainly most private clinicians and doctors, would start from a position that they want what's best for the child and for the child to make as much progress as possible. Unfortunately, that's not the legal standard. And starting in 1982, just a few years after the law was passed, when a Supreme Court decision was issued in a case called Rowley versus Hendrick Hudson School District, the Supreme Court indicated that schools were not obligated to provide a level of services that would allow the child to maximize progress or to fulfill their highest potential. I think inaccurately, but nonetheless commonly, schools interpreted that decision to mean that as long as the child made some progress, the school had done its job. And it's hard to imagine any parent being satisfied with some progress as opposed to as much as possible. But even the idea of some progress became a source of conflict and debate, because oftentimes schools would indicate that a child's progress was acceptable as long as there was measurable progress, meaning it didn't have to be very much, but as long as there was performance higher than what had been the year before, they were doing their job. And in many ways, that level of progress seemed completely contradictory to what the law was about, because the law's overarching purpose is to help kids with disabilities to be as successful and self-sufficient as possible when they graduate from public school. And so how could it possibly be that this tiny amount of progress would be enough and acceptable if the ultimate goal was to make enough progress to be more independent? And indeed, I think many kids who I've met and worked with, the school was satisfied with such a low level of progress that the child really did not get a lot of help in developing skills that they were capable of developing that would allow them to be more independent as adults. And by the way, again, keeping in mind the child has a disability, they may not ever be fully independent. Depends on their disability and how well they do in response to sport. But the critical point in relation to that case that remains true today is that parents should avoid asking for what's best and avoid referring to or using language like better, ideal, optimal, desirable, helpful, preferred, the most, because everyone agrees that the Supreme Court isn't requiring the most. So even under this old Rowley case from 1982, I try to think about and encourage parents and clinicians to think about what does the child need in order to make reasonable progress? And in many cases, I was able to show, continue to be able to show, that the child's progress that the school is acknowledging is actually insufficient, even though they say it satisfies the appropriateness standard, and then force the school to provide a higher level of service in order to allow the child to make more progress. But there is sort of good news, which is that 2 years ago, after 40 years of fighting about what does the word appropriate mean and what is some progress, the Supreme Court, in a case called Endrew, E-N-D-R-E-W-F, involving a young man with autism, decided that finally this idea of some or a little benefit couldn't possibly have been what the Congress had in mind when they adopted this massive law that applies to all 50 states and requires special education for millions of children and involves billions of dollars of expense. They couldn't possibly have been intending that just a little progress would be enough. And so the court adopted a new standard, which is confusing and vague, but clearly rejected the idea of some benefit being enough. And instead, the court said several things that are helpful in identifying what the school should do. The first thing that the court said is that the decision about progress needed to be assessed based on the child's individual circumstances. And that's important because it means the school can't use a one-size-fits-all that says, in effect, this child is making progress compared to everybody else, therefore they're okay or something like that. But based on where the child started, where they've been moving, and what they might need. The second thing that the court did that's very important kind of is a substitute for goals that allow for some progress, is the court said that the school has to develop challenging goals. They did not define what challenging goals means, and my prediction would be that the next 20 years will be spent fighting over what the word challenging means. But my own preferred definition of challenging, which I think is pretty logical and consistent with the court's interpretation and explanation, is that challenging for anybody is something that's at the outer edge of what we believe them to be capable of doing, rather than something that we're confident or sure that they can do. And so it is looking for us to not set up the child to fail, but to create an expectation for both the child and, in fact, for the educator, because the goals also are a way of driving a plan for what the educators are going to do, that won't be easy,
no.
That won't be certain, and that is likely, if it's met, to by definition mean the child is making more progress rather than less. And then the final thing that the court said that goes hand in hand with that, that's very important, is that the school is supposed to have an ambitious program that can meet the child's needs. And again, they didn't define what that meant, but we all can have our own idea of what ambitious means. And ambitious means something that, again, is robust and intended to push towards the outer edge of what's possible rather than something that's certain or minimal. And so this is a real different way to think about goals and to think about what a child can accomplish and to think about what the child should get from the school that should really strengthen the parent's ability to push for more in the way of expectations and to push for more in the way of programming, both content, amount, type, intensity, training of the staff, and so on. And so then I want to add one more thing, and then maybe it's a good point to summarize. And that is that the IDEA does require for kids who are 14 and a half or older that the school develop something called a transition plan. And the transition plan is supposed to be based on the parents and the child's identification with the team of reasonable post-secondary goals, which are what you hope the child will be able to do in terms of academics, in terms of job, community, where they live, their level of independence after they graduate from high school or reach the age of 22. And that's a very powerful thing because instead of just the little bits of progress that schools typically looked at under Rowley or even the ambitious goals under Andrew, the transition plans require that the school and the parent look ahead to the future and see what the child can do. And in my mind, the reason I bring this up now is that the idea of a post-secondary goal that's robust and promotes independence goes hand in hand with the new stronger standards of Andrew F. And so when parents, even for the child who's not 14 and a half yet, if the parent is meeting resistance from the school in relation to the goals, the parent should be making clear that they're looking for goals and for programming under Andrew F. that are likely to allow the child to be more independent when they are older. Doesn't mean that they will necessarily have no issues or their disability won't be still a factor, but that they'll be as independent as possible. And that's something that should be the driver for the team discussion, starting even when the child is in kindergarten. And then by the time the child hits 14 and a half and is in high school or reaching high school, then it's not only the driver, it's really the overarching consideration for what the programming should be. And so parents should emphasize the idea of ambitious programming, the idea of challenging goals, and the idea of a program that's designed to allow the child to achieve realistic post-secondary goals.
It's a lot to know.
Yeah, it's a lot to know.
I know. I feel like transition is something I definitely want to come back to with a few people who are expert in that area. And also, we've talked about goals a few times in the past, and there's a lot of expertise required even at a classroom teacher level.
Sure.
In the instructional hierarchy, which is another thing we'll go into, but where do you go from where? You know, every goal is based on previous data, which may or may not be good,
yeah.
And what the teacher's familiar with, which varies from district, school to school. So the more you can know, the better. Well, okay. So let's try to summarize here some of the main things that we've covered. I'd like to go back to, again, just the reality, I guess,
sure.
Is one thing to understand.
I think that the reality is that parents have a lot of rights but they're in a complicated and in some ways one-sided relationship with the school. And it's important for parents to be careful about how they manage that relationship, how they identify ways to build alliances with the teachers and to work collaboratively with the teachers, to promote communication with the teachers, and at the same time to be careful in picking their battles about the things that they need to push on if they're getting pushed back. And so on the one hand, not to have fights that are unnecessary or about things that are not important. And on the other hand, to be clear in their effort to get their child what they need, that there may be times, and the law does give them the right to push hard for their child, if there are things happening that they feel involve real inadequacies in the school's program or staff or plan or what communication or implementation, any of those things that are really leading the child to struggle in ways that shouldn't be happening. And so, at the risk of a horrible cliche, I would say that it's very important to promote positive relations, bring presents and donuts and be nice and appreciative and all of those things. And on the other hand, to be vigilant and to be monitoring carefully, to not take things for granted. And then after working hard to collaborate, if things are still not going well, to make sure you've got good information, but step up and push for the school to do what's needed.
Yeah, so I think my take on that is treat your school team as allies,
right,
until really somebody is apparently other. Really assume that everybody went, I feel that they took that job because they care about helping your child.
Right.
And that unfortunately, if you don't receive perhaps that, I brought up school psychologists, for example, shared resources among schools is just a reality. So if it's hard to access someone, they may not be being evasive. Sure. It may just be an unfortunate consequence of not having the resources.
Well, I think that's right. And I think that the other thing would be that parents need to be strategic about how they approach the school. Recognize that teachers have feelings too. They want to be appreciated. They have a right to be appreciated. They also are likely to feel defensive if they're insulted or called out publicly or criticized in settings where their colleagues are present. And so as much as possible, build relationships with the staff. And then if problems come up, think about how to try to resolve that problem that will be most likely to leave everyone feeling okay rather than to polarize. So for example, if there's a problem with a particular staff member, try to work it out with that person first privately. And if that's not successful, think about how you can bring it up with other people without creating embarrassment or humiliation or forcing the team into a position where they kind of circle the wagons and see it as a us against them situation. So I always encourage parents where there's a problem to consider whether there's a private or informal way to work it out rather than in a confrontation or in an IEP meeting with everyone there.
And memorialize it. Keep it in email. Yeah. That was definitely, that's definitely something that's been said before. Again, teachers and parents, whoever you are.
Right.
Especially if you sense some sort of conflict, I think that alone, sometimes putting it down, you know, I think I heard you say.
Yeah.
And just privately to that person initially so that they can maybe mull over what was said and if that is a good stance to take.
Absolutely.
Officially.
Yeah. Right? Makes sense. Good.
Yeah. Finally, just considering that progress, FAPE, that's all up for interpretation, I guess. Parents aren't equal partners, but the more informed you are.
Well, and parents have, although they may not be equal partners in terms of power, nonetheless, they do have recourse to due process procedures, mediation, complaints to the state, and so on, that are not there in regular education. And those things should be used judiciously, sparingly, but they give the parent a backup plan. And schools have a need and an investment in avoiding those problems also. So usually parents, if they can be clear that they're not going to back down, but are willing to talk and work things out, things can get worked out without having to get into an all-out battle or war.
Okay. And teachers, I think, on you, it's a pretty big ask to become more expert in this backward planning, right?
Right.
All the way back from transition,
yeah.
even at an elementary level. And I know the overwhelm
of
all that. I'll try to help.
Yeah.
So, well, thank you very much, Matt. I'm going to post these resources again on my website. You can see those links in the show notes and send any questions you have to the voice message listed as well. Thanks.
Great. That was fun.